Introduce our guests?
Yes, I will. We are here with folks from Art Oh My in the town of Oh My, right? I guess it used to be the town of Oh My. It's now the town of Ghent here in Columbia County. And Akimi Hyatt is here as she's the communications manager at Art Oh My. And I'll let her introduce our two writers. I talked a little earlier about the fact that you're going to be doing a public reading of the artists in residence. There are 9 writers and translators, is that right, who are in residence now at Art Oh My?
Yes, there are roughly 9. They do overlap different weeks. Their session runs from the spring into mid-June. And so right now we will have 9 reading with us on Saturday. And we have 2 of them here today to read from their work, Jennifer and Andre. And so the program was founded in 1991 by Francis Greenberger, who's the founder of Art Oh My International Art Center. We have 4 distinct residency programs for writers, visual artists, musicians, and dancers. And it was founded in 1991. His father was Sanford Greenberger, who was a literary agent, published works by Vladimir Nabokov, amongst many other luminaries of that time. So we're very excited to have this group with us this season. It's always a one-of-a-kind mix of people coming from all different countries, living together, sharing their work. They will have the opportunity to do that with the public, which is a free event on Saturday, and we'll have a barbecue afterwards, so we can all get to know each other out by the Field Sculpture Park.
Nice, thank you. Do you want to introduce the writers and tell us a little bit about them? Or they can perhaps tell us themselves.
Yeah, why don't we do it that way? Let them introduce themselves. Let's start with Jennifer.
Okay. I'm Jennifer Style.
There we go.
I'm a writer. I write both fiction and nonfiction. My first book was a memoir called The Woman Who Fell from the Sky, which is about the time I spent as editor-in-chief of a newspaper in Sana'a, Yemen.
Wow.
Yemen. And I have a novel coming out this coming March called The Ambassador's Wife. And I'm working on my third book right now at Ledig House at Art Oh My.
And your third book is fiction or nonfiction?
It's also fiction. It's called The Deep Water Running Gang, but it has a ways to go, this one.
And I'm Andre Nafisahili, and I'm a poet and a translator. I translate from French, Italian, and Arabic, both novels and poetry. And I guess I took up translation because at the end of my MFA course, when I asked my tutor what I should do in order to make this writing a practical reality, he said, well, just go on unemployment benefits. What? So I started to translate full time in order to not do that.
Was that an American MFA?
No, that was in Scotland.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Which university?
St. Andrews.
Oh, who was your advisor?
Don Patterson.
Oh.
Just for the record.
The poet.
Yeah.
He's a great poet.
He's an absolutely fantastic poet, yeah.
Well, who would like to read first? I guess maybe we'll ask you a little more. So you're a poet, but you've been translating as a way to make a living as well?
Yeah, that's right.
I noticed you translated the new book about the last days of Stefan Zweig. Was that the one that was reviewed recently in the New York Review of Books?
You know what? I'm not sure because of being up at Oh My and another residency before that, I've kind of been fairly cut off.
Yeah, who wrote that?
That was Laurent Saxic. He was recently shortlisted for the Goncourt as well. The book has been reviewed extensively.
Yeah,
I know that because Zweig remains such a fascinating figure, even for these times. And that book is actually the only commission I've ever taken on. A publisher who I know said, you know, I'm sure you'd like this. Why don't you take a look? And I was completely won over. It's a beautiful book.
Yeah, and it's kind of an odd end to his story, right? I mean...
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's...
After a pretty successful life in Weimar, Germany, or...
Absolutely. I mean, he was literally the world's most successful author. He sold millions of books. was quite a collector, so he owned Mozart's original manuscripts.
He had
various paraphernalia belonging to famous artists. And the sad fact is that he committed suicide along with his second wife, who was far younger than him, about 2 or 3 weeks before the fall of Singapore in 1942. So essentially, if he'd waited for a few more weeks, he would have seen the tide of the war turn, and would have seen the hope that the Nazis would finally be vanquished. But he essentially killed himself because he thought that he should do it himself before the Nazis came knocking at his door.
Interesting. The book, and I'm pretty sure the book you translated was reviewed, and they also mentioned Wes Anderson's new movie as being very much inspired by the work of Stefan Zweig.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that I haven't seen the film yet.
Yeah, I haven't either.
being up here, but I've had a few friends who said they had, and they were actually displeased with it on a variety of levels. Mostly because that Zweig's writing has this wonderfully melancholic nostalgia for an old world that he saw literally vanish before his eyes. And I think Wes Anderson probably tried to capture that, but I'm told that not too successfully. But
so again. Your multilingualism is a reflection partly of your own background? Or...
More a result of circumstance, I think. I mean, I am mixed race. My mother's Italian, my father's Iranian. But I acquired all the languages I speak primarily when I went to live in the Emirates. I was 5 years old. My father's an architect, and he moved us out there. I acquired them purely because no one spoke Italian in the desert.
Mm-hmm.
I had to. I don't think I've got a particular aptitude for languages, although I probably shouldn't say that.
No, so. I know what that's like. I've studied four and I still can't do anything with any of them.
Yeah, and I think a lot of it has to do with the right age, you know? I think it was Cicero who said that the optimum age for acquiring languages is between 5 and 9.
Yeah.
And so I think that comes into. Yeah.
So most of your translation, so you say the Zweig was something that was proposed to you. Most of them you do out of love for what the text is?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Zweig book I kind of see as a fluke in the sense that whenever I decide to take on an author, I look at the text, and it's a difficult process to describe, but I basically try to insert myself on the page and see. It's like trying on a glove. You know, it's either going to fit or not. I don't think I'd ever be able to translate a book that I didn't feel some kind of kinship with the theme or the author's sensibility or style. In the sense of, you know, to just make a random example, if someone writes very strict rhyme, which I don't, with my own poetry, I write free verse, I probably wouldn't translate poetry that rhymes specifically because I don't really have the background that would allow me to produce good versions.
Right. Now, I've been reading Clive James's recent translation of Dante, and he made an unusual choice that way. He knew he couldn't recreate Dante's Terza Rima, so he came up with a solution that had some rhyme, but wasn't free verse, which is what most contemporary translators choose to do.
Absolutely.
When you decided to do some Zola, was it because all the old the other translations are all kind of out of date, right? I mean, they're kind of...
Well, absolutely. I mean, they're completely out of date. The book I translated, which is called Money, and it's going to come out next in summer 2015.
It's in the Penguin Classics, right? That's a great series to be in.
Yeah, it's been really good to work with them, and they're very interested in commissioning new translations of these works. I think that translation itself was almost 120 years old. So not only was it about time that a new translation came out and reintroduced this book, but what I learned during the process was I didn't read the old translation until after I completed mine to make sure that there wasn't any crossover or any influence. But I also discovered that back then, because the translator was working, when Victorian mores were still very much in force, and so he bowdlerized the text. He edited all the sex out. Yeah. Whenever a woman talks or speaks, or thinks anything profound, it immediately gets cut because, of course, women weren't allowed to do that in Victorian times. So it's not so much. This will be actually the first integral translation.
Unless you were George Eliot.
Yeah, exactly. The first uncensored translation. Yeah. I mean, the my predecessor, Henry Vizzatelli, was actually imprisoned quite a few times for his work on Zola, who, you know, he was radical enough for the French at the time, but the British really couldn't stomach his work. And so even though Zola at the moment has a reputation as being quite dry and stiff, that's because he was badly translated, because his translator simply couldn't keep going to jail, or he was sued several times as well for you know, basically publishing such licentious literature.
Now, do you translate in the other directions at all?
No, never.
Okay.
No.
And how does translation feed your work as a poet, or does it?
You know what? I came across one of the best answers for this kind of question was not mine. It was this is to be found in John Ashbery's Collected Translations, where he's got the prose volume reproduces an essay by a French critic who talks about Alberto Giacometti's work, and he says you can't separate the paintings from the sculpture. They are all part of one artistic process. So I guess that the translations of poetry and prose that I do inevitably have an effect on my own work, and vice versa. Because any translation, especially good ones, they're never an accurate reflection of the original. Not 100%. It's never a mirror image. It can't be. There's always some original quirk that the translator brings to that work.
So, and your MFA was in poetry with Don Patterson.
Yeah.
Did you bring any with you?
I did. I did, actually.
I think it's time for a poem, Ellen.
Sure.
We've got to class up this show.
All right.
Impossible.
This comes from the beginning of a collection I just finished, which is called Islands of Strangers. And this poem in particular is called Disposable Cities. Kind of inspired by, you know, the old Kodaks, 29 shots, and then you throw them out. Disposable Cities. They begin as rumors, snippets of exaggerated talk, too fabulous to believe, but too alluring to forget. Something has been found. Gold, silver, rubber, uranium, coltan, or oil. Before long, the promise of immeasurable wealth drowns all incredulity. They become barely visible blips on the horizon of prospects. The engineers in their hard hats and linens are the first on the ground, and with them come derricks, drills, platforms, and dry docks. Pipelines sink their tentacles into every lucrative crevice marked on the map. The maps are kept secret. A handful of shacks are erected to provide a few basic services. Soon enough, the handful swells into a hamlet, then a village, and finally a city. They are the perfect sort of settlement for the modern world. Everything is shipped in and easily assembled. The cities have a primary and overriding purpose: to extract, process, and distribute. Just like a motorized pump draws water out of a well, they start inhaling people from all over the world, one desperado at a time. At first, these new arrivals find their new homes unsettling. They find it difficult to adjust to their weird climates and are frazzled by the confusion of languages. No one is under any illusions. They are ephemeral guests, non-citizens. Belonging is a dream best forgotten or deferred. Most have come empty-handed, having traded their old lives for grubstakes. Lots of money slushes around, but most of it is spent just staying alive. And when it runs out, people watch their lives fall apart. Everyone lives in a heightened state of awareness. One false move, and they're gone. The poorer they are, the more modest their gambles, which more often than not make them poorer. Beggars don't build homelands, they tell themselves, fantasizing about the day when they might return home and become someone. Meanwhile, the myth travels to the four corners of the world. More than cities, these Eldorados are a state of mind, places where people come to reinvent themselves and live out their most eccentric fantasies. All conurbations live out their lot and die, but these disposable cities are special. Mushrooms of greed that can burst out of nowhere. Greenland, the Amazon, the Yukon, the empty quarter. Areas of the world usually thought uninhabitable. Their fame is fleeting. Once bled dry, their roads go raw with potholes. Chickens roam loose in the opera houses. Power lines sag, and then rot seeps in and tars all in sight. Only those unlucky enough not to make it in town stay for the decline. One day, the wind howls and the last tent comes undone. the lie has moved on to the next disposable city. When I was a child, my mother used to tell me that lies had short legs and thus could not get very far. Somebody lied to her.
That's great. That was Andre Nafis Sahili. Did you write that in Omai?
No, but it was edited at Omai. So
oh, okay.
Thanks be to
so
Omai.
It's so and so it hasn't been published yet.
It's one of the opening pieces in my first collection, which is coming out next year.
Oh, okay. So we kind of broke something here, Ellen. A literary first.
Yeah.
It's sort of news.
Yeah.
You know, poetry, the news, it stays news. Right?
Good old heads are pound.
Okay, that was great. Thank you. And now to our next guest, Jennifer Style. Now, you've been working on fiction mostly lately, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Your background, though, is as a journalist?
It is.
So, like every journalist, you wanted to write a novel?
Actually, I wanted to write a novel long before I became a journalist. Actually, I started out as an actor and then became a writer and then realized that if I didn't want to waitress the rest of my life, I'd have to get a marketable skill, so I went to journalism school.
Don't say that too often here in Hudson, because you'll ruin a lot of careers.
Sorry. So, yeah. No, so my first book was nonfiction, and kind of after that, I wanted the freedom to lie about stuff and make things up. And
that doesn't seem to prevent many nonfiction writers from proceeding these days.
Yeah.
You know, the lines have continued to be blurred, if you've
noticed.
Yes,
but I'm not a fan of blurring lines.
Yeah.
Every word of my first book is...
Are you familiar with this guy, John Begatta?
John Begatta. I'm not.
He's teaching at Iowa, and he actually makes a case for blurring these lines, and it's just freaking me out.
We had a dinner table discussion about this the other night at Omai, actually.
Hey, invite me out. Maybe I can add something. No, I'm kidding. So you're working on fiction, and are you getting to write much while you're at it, Omai?
Oh, yes. I'm writing a ton. I live in Bolivia, where I have a 4-year-old daughter and a lot of other obligations. My husband's a diplomat there, so it's a luxury to have an entire day to spend writing.
Right. And they feed you.
They feed us way too well. We're all getting chubby, I think. But, yeah, they feed us.
Now, I have a poet friend who just, you know, loves these kind of things because she has 3 kids. And it's the only time she ever gets away from them. Well, now they're kind of grown up, but it's a big deal to be able to get away when you're younger.
It is. I mean, I'm shocked by how much I've managed to get done. I'm about to finish the first draft of my 3rd book, and I didn't think I would do that while I was here. So I'm pretty happy.
Well, let's see. So you want to read some of it?
I brought my, the book I'm working on now is still too rough, I think, to read, but I have the book that's coming out in March, which I've also never read from before, ever.
This is The Ambassador's Wife.
This is The Ambassador's Wife.
So it is vaguely autobiographical.
It's not at all autobiographical. I want to be very clear about that. I was ideally placed for the research, but it is definitely not autobiographical.
Is it set in Bolivia?
It's set in a nameless Middle Eastern country,
oh,
which bears some resemblance to Yemen, but which is not Yemen. Which is definitely not Yemen.
Well, you know, Yemen's pretty exciting place to have been.
It was great. I was there for 4 years. So we really did love Yemen, actually.
Is he in the American Foreign Service?
No, my husband's British.
Oh.
So.
Okay. Well,
anyway.
let's hear it.
Okay. I'm going to just start from the beginning and read a very brief preface and then the beginning of the first chapter.
Okay. Is that okay with you, Ellen?
Okay. All right. September 17th, 2010. As she curls herself around the wasted body of a stranger's child, cupping the tiny head in her hand, the remembered glow of a painting emerges unbidden from the gloom of Miranda's mind. A woman sleeps in a boat, reclined in her husband's arms and draped alongside the body of her sleeping child, bathed in a benediction of pale light. Around them are dark water and a darker shore. The woman's body is limp, trusting, abandoned to its fate. Opposite the slumbering family, fortune plies the oars with the assistance of a hopeful Cupid. Something about the image, the family's relinquishing of control over their destiny, fills Miranda with terror. They drift, serenely dreaming, into darkness. Wake, she wants to cry to them. Wake up and take an oar. Fortune and Cupid are unreliable guides. As the baby tugs at her breast, Miranda gazes down at her with dull eyes, trying to remember the name of the painting. What was it? The child whimpers as a nipple slips away from her mouth. She's too weak to suck for long. The dream of happiness. That was it. Constance Meyer's dream of happiness. she who had known so little of it in her own life. When Miranda thinks back on her brief time with Cresta and Finn, this is the image that keeps returning to her. A moment of blissful unconsciousness and then black. Part one. The book alternates between Miranda's point of view, she's the American wife of a British ambassador, and her husband's. This is Miranda. It is not autobiographical.
I didn't say a word.
Miranda watches her left hand move across her sketch pad as if unsure of its destination. Up it swoops, leaving a sooty trail across the thick white paper. Then across to the right, down again, across a frame. The pencil lifts from the page for a moment, hovering in midair as her eyes turn toward the window. Dawn arrives abruptly in Mizrook, the sky slipping from black to gold in the few seconds it took Miranda to pour a cup of coffee. Their garden is already gilded, its vast lawn glittering with last night's rain, its neat rows of flowers unclenching and tilting upwards towards the sun. Along the periphery is a procession of crooked trees leaning against the iron spikes of the gates like tired sentries. Bougainvillea crawls up the walls and thrusts its blooms through the bars, unwilling to be contained. Across the far end of the grass stretches the pool, as yet undisturbed by morning swimmers. The sky, as always at this hour, is a relentless, cloudless blue. Miranda's view of this paradise, this oasis of theirs in this desert country, is partitioned into eight nearly equal parts by wrought iron bars. Painted white, they form a lace-like scrim across the window. The ornate curlicues of steel strive to disguise their utilitarian nature, but fail. Her hand has gone back to work. The iron bars unfurl across her page, but as they would be seen from outside. For behind the bars is not a garden, but a girl. A woman vivisected, her head framed here, her heart here. Here her hand and here her mouth. Drawing, Miranda often feels like an adolescent toying with a Ouija board, wondering to what degree she subconsciously controls the movements of its indicator. Simultaneously creator and conduit, she can rarely predict exactly what will emerge. So absorbed is she in her puzzle pieces that she doesn't hear the alarm at first. How long has it been buzzing? She hasn't yet touched the mug of coffee on the table in front of her or made Finn's cup of tea. Barefoot, she runs down the hall to their bedroom and lunges for the alarm on Finn's bedside table. Why had they set the alarm? They have a child. They don't need an alarm. Then she remembers the policemen. The policemen are still here, which means she has to dress for breakfast. Pausing by the bed, she listens. Nothing. Cressida still safely asleep. Sweetheart, gently, she shakes Finn's shoulder, kisses his eyelids. I'm awake, he says. Clearly not. I am. I'm wide awake. He says this without moving, without opening an eye. Finn is not a morning person. On weekdays, he rises at 6 a.m. to eat breakfast before heading to the embassy by 7:30. But on weekends, he'll sleep all day if she doesn't wake him. I'll get your tea. In the little private kitchen between their room and Cressida's, where she habitually spends the first hour of the day with her sketch pad, Miranda brews a mug of Earl Grey. Finn won't drink her coffee. She makes it too strong. After leaving his tea on the side table by his still motionless head, she returns to the kitchen for her own mug. At best, she gets an hour of blissful solitude, but today she is only 20 minutes more because she needs to scramble into a sundress. She rarely has the luxury of solitary mornings once she leaves the relative privacy of their upstairs suite. By the time she slips down the marble staircase, their Ethiopian housekeeper Nagasi will be busy in the kitchen, slicing mangoes and melons, peeling pomegranates and brewing coffee. Bird-like Desta will have already begun polishing the downstairs bathrooms, and Jonas and Samiri will be pulling up weeds in the flower beds and tending to their vegetable patches. Miranda wouldn't have thought much would take root in the cracked earth of this arid city, but their figs, lettuce, broccoli, tomatoes, and rhubarb thrive. By the time Miranda and Finn have finished their muesli and fruit, swallowed the last of their coffee or tea. Okay, sorry.
Okay.
There's just two paragraphs
okay,
more.
Sure.
Okay. And wipe their mouths with the rainbow striped cloth napkins. Tara will be in the kitchen, slowly turning the pages of their cookbooks as she writes her shopping list. Though often deprived of solitude, Miranda is awash in other luxuries. She doesn't have to cook. She doesn't do her own laundry. And best of all, she doesn't have to leave the house unless she wants to. She can paint all day. I'll stop there.
Now that was a good place because it tied in with our earlier food show.
Okay.
It sounded like they had
I wanted to get to their conversation with Finn, but I realized we're out of time.
Sorry. That was Jennifer Style, and that's from her forthcoming book, The Ambassador's Wife, which is going to be published by Doubleday this coming year. No.
Yes.
This
March.
Year?
Okay. Well, March 2015.
March 2015.
Yeah.
So we've had two writers representing the group at Oh My right now. Ellen, can you quickly tell everybody once again how they can hear them read in person?
They can be at Art Oh My at 5 o'clock on Saturday. Art Oh My being at 1405 County Route 22 in Ghent. And the writers and translators are going to be reading from their work for the public, followed by a barbecue where you get to meet everyone. So is there anything else we need to know, Akimi?
No, that's all. I hope you can all come out on Saturday. If you can't, but the next time you can come out is June 15th. We're having new works in the field and architecture, Oh My, new sculptures in the park.
When's the music? When's the music?
That's that's not until July.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because we always have Jeff on.
But I will let you know. Okay. I don't know if they could all fit in here, but.
We got a bunch of them last time.
Really?
Yeah.
Well,
Ellen, I hate to cut you off, but we got to go.
Oh, we do, don't
well,
we?
Well, yeah.
Okay.
Sadly, I mean, this has been a great day. We've actually had, I can't say that. We actually had interesting guests. No, I mean, we always.
We actually had fun.
We always have interesting guests.
No, you both, thank you so much for coming. It was a real
yes,
treat.
Yes, thank you very
us.
Much.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you, guys.
This has been the Thursday Afternoon Show, and I have just enough time to play a little bit of our new theme song as we say goodbye.
Thank you.
Go to work today. Thursday is such a crazy, lazy day. Thursday has its own peculiar way of saying hey. Sometimes Thursday almost makes you want to run away. Thursday, such a crazy, lazy day.